everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today we're previewing some of the titles shortlisted for this year's Silip Carnegie Medal. Sophie Anderson opens the door to the house with chicken legs.
The whole experience of death is about celebrating life rather than focusing on what they'd lost.
Elizabeth Acevedo combats teenaged angst with slam poetry in The Poet X.
Her notebook is the place where she can imagine a bigger version of herself than the world sees.
Kate Saunders finds relief from grief in The Land of Never Endings.
And it's about the kind of space of imagination and fun, if you like, that is worth saving when somebody dies.
And we talk to an author who's won the Carnegie Medal twice, Geraldine McCorcoran. That's all coming up on today's Read On. The Carnegie Medal is the UK's oldest prize for children's literature. Founded in 1936, its list of winners includes some of the best-known and most-loved children's authors writing in English. The organisers, SILIP, the Library and Information Association, work closely with RNIB to ensure that all the books on the shortlist are made fully accessible. And a group of blind and partially sighted pupils from New College Worcester are among the many children who shadow the selection of the winner. This year, 8 titles are in contention and, as usual, Read On was keen to interview as many of the authors as possible. First up, Sophie Anderson's debut novel, The House with Chicken Legs, has been a runaway success that's been shortlisted for a host of prizes, including the Carnegie. It's based on a Slavic folk tale and, as we'll hear, there's a family connection. Sophie Anderson, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Could you introduce us to The House with Chicken Legs, please?
The House with Chicken Legs is a book about a girl called Marinka, who's 12 years old, and she lives with her grandmother, Baba Yaga, in a house with chicken legs. Essentially, the book is about she's trying to escape a lonely destiny as the next guardian of the gate. She's been told her whole life that she's to follow in the footsteps of her grandmother Baba Yaga and become a guardian of the gate between this world and the next, where she's just sort of destined for this life guiding the dead, which she doesn't want to do. She sees it as a lonely life. She wants more of a normal life with friends and in a normal house that doesn't get up and walk off. And basically that's the story, is her trying to carve her own destiny.
Baba Yaga is a Yaga. She's a guide for the dead to the
dead,
spirit
world. So, yeah, basically. So dead souls come to her house every night, and she cooks food for them and throws parties for them to celebrate their lives. And then she guides them through this gate where they go on to whatever comes next. But it's kind of like a joyful celebration, because although the book's kind of about death, I wanted it to be in a kind of positive way, where it's portrayed as just the circle of life, and that the whole experience of death is about celebrating life rather than focusing on what they'd lost. But from Marinka's point of view, she's just 12 years old and she only meets the dead, and they're only there for one night, whereas she wants more lasting friendships.
Yes, which is very much the quandary that faces an awful lot of children starting at new schools.
They
want to make lasting friends rather than
lasting friendships. Yes, indeed. And I think Marinka, she, even though she lives in this very imaginative world that obviously children don't live in houses with chicken legs and have this destiny, I think Marinka's central issue is that she wants to control her own life, which I think is what all children, especially at sort of 11 and 12 as they're growing up, that's what they want as well. They sort of want to rebel against the fences and the boundaries drawn around them and create their own lives and make their own friends. So I think that's the thing that children will relate to. And then it's in this imaginative setting.
She wants to create her own destiny rather than have it foisted upon her.
Yes, exactly. She wants to control her own life, essentially. But in the situation she's in, the house is essentially controlling her life, because the house can get up and walk off whenever it wants, basically. So as soon as she starts to make a friend, the house tends to get up and walk away, because it's trying to keep her in this like world where she's going to be the next Yaga. So that's what she's rebelling against. So the house is quite a parental character, really. You know, people sometimes ask, they say, who who inspire different things. And I think really I'm the house because I have children. I have four children. And obviously I try to control my children's lives. And obviously as they grow older, they start to rebel against me and they want to do their own thing, which is perfectly natural.
I believe the story is based not only on the Slavic Baba Yaga folklore story, but also partly on your grandmother's story.
Yeah, definitely. My grandmother inspired it because my grandmother is from Eastern Europe. She was from Eastern Europe. And so she told me loads of the Baba Yaga stories when I was young. So Baba Yaga definitely inspired it. But I think the character of Baba Yaga in the book is quite based on my grandmother. They're very similar. My grandmother lived through the war, so there was a lot of death in her past. She lost all her family and her home and things. But her home was full of joy. She was a musician and she loved food. And so I think Baba Yaga and her house in the book became very much like my grandmother, that they both sort of celebrated the lives that they'd have, even though there was some, you know, sort of death and misery in the past. Their homes were always welcoming and full of life and food and music. So definitely it was inspired by the folklore, but also my own family and my own life. Like Marinka is quite inspired by my eldest daughter, I think, because she's that sort of teenager where, you know, she wants her own life. As a writer, you sort of take inspiration from the world around you, definitely.
And as you say, it's a wonderfully uplifting, fun book with some lovely macabre humour in it. But death is at the centre of it. In some ways, it's a handbook for dealing with bereavement and for moving on from grief. Do you think this is something that actually we've forgotten in our generation and our children's generation? As you say, your grandmother had death far more on her doorstep.
Yes, I think in our society, all too often, death is something that is, it's not talked about openly. It's something that we sort of hush over and we can be afraid to talk about it, you know, until it's happened, and then it's quite difficult to talk about. And I thought it would be nice to write a book where you can sort of start these discussions and prepare children, because I think children are naturally curious about death, you know, and you can have discussions without it being solemn or macabre or, you know, or too depressing. I think, you know, I think death in a way, it can actually inspire us to enjoy life in a way, because it sort of reminds us that our lives are finite and we have to make the most of them. And that's what I sort of wanted the book to be. I wanted it to be about death, but really it's about life, and it's about inspiring people to make the most of their lives. And like you say, when people die, it's important that we celebrate their lives and that we focus on that. I think that can make grief easier. One of the reasons I wrote it is I'd experienced the loss of both my grandparents, and I lost my brother, and my partner lost both his parents all in the same year. And I had quite a dark year where it was all very dark and depressing. And then I think you get to a point where you come through it and you start to think, well, you know, I have to hang on to what is happy about their lives. I can't be sad every time I think about them. I should be thinking about these people and being happy that they lived and thinking of everything they gave me. And, you know, there is a better way of dealing with death, I think. Trying to, you know, focus on the happy times you have is one way to get through the grief.
Well, certainly The House with Chicken Legs is a joyous celebration of how important it is to live your life and not be hamstrung by grief. And it's your debut novel. Have you been surprised how warmly and successfully it's been greeted?
Absolutely. It's been absolutely astonishing. It is just incredible. It sort of started with, before it was published, it was chosen as Book of the Month in the bookseller. And I think from that point, it just sort of roller coasted. And then it was Waterston's Book of the Month. And I think all these things just sort of added in it. And it just became such a roller coaster of, you know, and it was just everywhere. But what's been the most wonderful thing is people getting in touch saying what a personal connection they've had, you know, and that's been wonderful. I had someone got in touch the other day and they used a section from the book at one of their parents' funerals and things like this, and lots of people have got in touch and said it's really helped them get through grief, and these are adults who are reading it, and then you have children get in touch and they're just inspired by the fun aspects. And I think it's wonderful that all different ages have been enjoying the book and taking what they need from it, if you see what I mean. And it is just absolutely astonishing, and it's wonderful because I just sat down and sort of wrote it for myself, and I think it's the first book I have published. I think I was writing for a long time before I was published, and so I think I got used to the idea of I just write and it's never going to be published and no one's going to read it, but I'm just writing it for myself. So to actually see loads of people enjoying it now is, it's incredible. It's, you know, it's a dream come true, I suppose. It's beyond a dream because I never really imagined it would happen.
Are there any plans for an audiobook version?
I'm not actually sure. I did get in touch with my agent the other day. The audio rights are with Usborne, so I think they have some plans for it. So I would imagine that is going to happen. But I'm not actually sure at the moment.
Well, I will keep my fingers crossed so that...
Yeah, I would imagine it will indeed. The rights have sold, like I say, so it is just a case of them, you know, arranging it all. But quite often the author's the last person to find out about these things.
Would you be keen to read it yourself?
No, I wouldn't actually, because I stutter, as you might notice, just a little bit, and I'd like it to be read by someone who's a professional. I think that would be good. I'm not sure I would do it justice. The voice in my head is lovely, but my own voice, I think, I don't think I'm professional enough. Basically, I'd like it to be done by someone else.
Well, I keep my fingers crossed for the audiobook version, and wish you the very best of luck for the announcement of the Philip Carnegie Medal.
Thank you.
The House with Chicken Legs is out now in print and ebook wherever you buy your books. Braille and giant print versions are available from RNIB Library. And Sophie will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Coming up later in this week's Carnegie Medal special, a blue bear and a black toad and the land of never endings, plus last year's winner Geraldine McCorkeran. But first, The Poet X is another debut novel, this time from renowned American slam poet Elizabeth Acevedo. The book is written entirely in verse and presented as a diary of its teenage protagonist, Chiamara.
I am unhideable, taller than even my father, with what mommy has always said was a little too much body for such a young girl. I am the baby fat that settled into D cups and swinging hips, so that the boys who called me a whale in middle school now ask me to send them pictures of myself in a thong. The other girls call me conceited, ho, thought, fast. When your body takes up more room than your voice, you are always the target of well-aimed rumors, which is why I let my knuckles talk for me, which is why I learned to shrug when my name was replaced by insults. I've forced my skin just as thick as I am.
Elizabeth Acevedo spoke to me via Skype from her home in Washington. Elizabeth Acevedo, welcome to Read On.
Thanks so much for having me.
So for readers who haven't yet got hold of The Poet X, could you tell us a little bit about the story?
The Poet X is the story of Xiomara Batista, a 15-year-old Dominican-American who is a secret poet. She writes all of her feelings down into a journal, but she really struggles with talking out loud, with pushing back against some of the rules and confines that she finds herself in because of gender norms and cultural norms. And her notebook is the place where she can imagine a bigger version of herself than the world sees.
And she really does find a voice through being a poet. As she grows into the young woman that she's becoming, she's finding herself more and more pushed into other people's visions of what a stereotypical young woman in Harlem should be.
Right, exactly. That I think as you read along, you realize that the poetry is changing, her styles are changing, what she's attempting and risking in the writing is changing, but it's also a reflection of how her personality is also shifting. That she is also becoming a little bit bolder, a little bit more fierce in terms of how she's moving. And so it's this kind of, the content reflecting the craft, right? The writing is showing something, but it's also the writing is matching who she is becoming.
And she's having to put up with some pretty unpleasant behavior from the other people in her neighborhood. As she develops curves, she gets a lot of sexual harassment from all the men she has to walk past on her way to school.
Yes, I mean, I thought it was important. I don't know if I've seen urban catcalling in the way that I know it in literature. Certainly sexual harassment and you know, the prevalence of rape culture, but not necessarily the kinds of thing you find in a city, where if you're walking by a building or a street corner, construction workers, that very inescapable sense of your body always being on display. And it felt important to have this young woman who is, you know, really well developed and almost afraid of her body and afraid of what might happen because she's in it, to have her kind of look around and reconsider, what is it that I'm doing and I'm not doing? What is it about the society that makes me some hyper visible but also completely invisible, right? Because no one really sees the parts of her that she wants to be shown, that she wants, you know, hey, I'm smart and I'm funny and I'm also kind, but all that people receive me as is as a body to be objectified.
And as you say, initially she's confiding her thoughts, her frustrations, her passion secretly to her diary in poetry form. And then as the book progresses, she's encouraged by her English teacher, Ms. Galliano, to explore and begin to perform that poetry and speak out.
Exactly, right? I think I've known so many young people who have immense talent in writing, and that little urge that you can tell, like, they light up when they think about it being read, or they'll pass it to a friend to read out loud, or they'll ask you to read it out loud. And they want it heard. They want the language to exist in the room, but they're just a little bit shy or a little bit afraid of being the actual vehicle that gets the words out. And so Xiomara is kind of like that. She's practicing at home. She's into hip hop and is used to seeing people performing poetry and all that jazz. But she is nervous about being the one that has to stand up. She has so much negative feelings around what it means to call attention to herself that she's not sure that there is a positive way to call attention to yourself. And so she's lucky to have, you know, a best friend who kind of pushes her to give things new tries, and also this incredible teacher who gently keeps pushing her to take up space and to be bold and to use her voice in ways that she didn't imagine she could.
You yourself are an award-winning poet who has won national awards in the US. I wondered how autobiographical the book was and whether you too had a Ms. Galliano who was an English teacher who encouraged you.
You know, like, it has autobiographical elements. Dominican girl, also poet from Harlem, New York. But I would say that there are the emotional truths of the story are certainly my own, right? I remember, you know, calling a lot of attention and not at a young age where I wasn't sure what to do with it, and the reactions of my family versus of my friends. I couldn't figure out how do I navigate this and what am I supposed to feel, right? I don't know. And so I gave some of those things to Xiomara, the feeling of coming from a household that has certain expectations of what a good girl is and wanting to redefine, you know, girlhood, wanting to redefine Dominicanness in a way that fit more comfortably, you know, on me. And so those things are elements that I certainly gave to Xiomara, but the actual story arc is a little bit different. I'm quite boring in comparison to the life that Xiomara lives. I like to think of her as my braver self, you know, the self I wish I could have been at her age, who was thoughtful in taking her life into her hands. I was lucky enough to begin performing when I was around that age and had a teacher in high school who encouraged me to slam. And I had a lot of people in my community who encouraged me to perform, but that was the first time when I was in my second year of high school where I began competing. And it was just a different rigor of preparation, of getting to know other people who were taking language and performance just as seriously, not necessarily at an open mic or at a theater, which is where I was used to doing poems, but this was now, you were trying to create a standard of excellence that you wanted to meet time and time again, and saying, I am top-notch quality, you know, my work is. And so I was lucky to have a teacher who really believed that I was a strong writer and a strong performer. Her name is Miss Lublin, and we still keep in touch, and, you know, I owe so much to her.
And in many ways, you're taking up that baton and encouraging other teenagers, other young women to find their voice and be brave enough to speak up.
Completely. I mean, I love going into classrooms and doing workshops and encouraging the shyest students, the students who don't usually speak up, to maybe say something, to read a couple of lines or read a stanza. And sometimes they'll read the whole poem. Or, you know, all of the young women who write to me, I get emails and snail mail letters of folks who weren't sure that they could share their work. And then they read the Poet X and really felt like they had permission to talk about what they're writing, that their writing didn't just have to be for them. And folks who didn't know that they could write at all and began writing or journaling or have felt this desire to write but didn't think they were good enough and are now starting to craft poetry. And so I don't think that's what I set out to do when I wrote the Poet X. I wanted to affirm young people and their voices, but I didn't know there was going to be such a sweep of people who felt seen by the novel and because of it wanted to begin writing their own stories.
The novel has been incredibly well received and obviously shortlisted for our most prestigious children's writing award, the Sir Lip Carnegie. A lot of people have expressed surprise that it is a novel in poetry and yet it's so easy to read and so accessible. Was it easy for you to write it entirely in verse? And are you surprised by people's reactions to it?
I didn't know what the heck I was doing when I began writing this book. I had read a lot. I had read a lot of specifically within the young adult category because my students were in eighth grade and that's what they were reading and I wanted to be in touch. But when I began this, I had around 40 pages and I was like, okay, there's a story, right? Like I didn't know how to sustain 368 pieces of poetry with a story arc. And it was teaching myself that some of the verse had to just be a hinge between what had happened and what was happening next, right? That they're not complete poems in the way that I have been taught to think of a poetry collection, right? That everything stands on its own, that some of these pieces are in conversation and they're moving the plot along, but it's really hand in hand. How is the language elevated in such a way that it is clear there is lyric and poetry in it, but not at in such a way that it is disservicing the plot, right? That the story has to move on. And so learning that kind of balance of the narrative needs to move forward, but also the language has to be compelling. It took me, you know, 6 years to figure out how to do. And I'm partly surprised at the reception, certainly the global reception that I was told when I received my book deal, that it probably wouldn't get a lot of foreign rights, that poetry was hard to translate, that, you know, the story felt very specific. It was a very U.S. story. And so to know that it has been, you know, translated into 12 languages, that all over the world it's being received with so much love is a little bit astounding. But at the same time, I think there is a universal theme to wanting to find yourself and the coming of age story told from a specific point of view that maybe we haven't seen before. And I tried my best to be unflinchingly honest. And I think that that is what folks are responding to when they say this feels powerful for them, is that I didn't know who would read it. And so I didn't shy away from saying what needed to be said.
The fact that you're a spoken word poet, a slam poet, and that you've written it in verse argues that it is perfect as an audiobook. And I know there's one published in the States, and I believe that it's going to be published over here very soon. You must be delighted that you're reaching an audience who might be print disabled for one reason or another, and who are able to appreciate your writing, though they can't read it.
Oh, most certainly. I mean, I come from oral storytellers, right? I come from folks who, my grandfather had a third grade education. He was a farmer in the rural countryside of the Dominican Republic, but was brilliant and would memorize these long riddles that he would recount time and time again, you know, from memory. And so I think about what it meant to grow up with music, with my grandfather's stories, with my mother's stories. I didn't have a lot of Disney. You know, we had two movies, The Lion King and The Little Mermaid, and that was it. Those were the fairy tales I had, but I had my mother's stories of where she was from, and that's what she would put me to bed with at night. And so for me, there is this connection to what does it mean to use your body and your voice to get a story across. And to know that the audiobook does that, that someone can be driving and listening to a story, that someone can be sitting at home and maybe for whatever reason can't read the text, but I can deliver it with my voice or someone else kind of voice actor, I think just really reimagines how large story can be and what we can walk into, and also what literature can be. That we kind of want to say maybe that's a different thing, but no, that is just as important as text that is written down. And so because probably I'm a performer and we have so many stigmas in the States about page versus stage and oral poetry versus real, quote unquote, like I think all of that is just quite silly, right? Because for the longest time, poetry wasn't written down and the majority of the population wasn't able to read it if it had been. And so I'm glad that audiobooks are becoming as popular as they are, because I think it returns it to people.
One thing that you might not know is that were you to win the Philip Carnegie Medal, you would be presented with a Braille copy of your book by the Royal National Institute for the Blind's Library.
I'm literally clutching my chest right now. I wish you could see me, because, you know, the thought of how many folks could find the novel that maybe haven't seen this kind of story in Braille and now would have access to this character in this world just really, really overwhelms me a little bit, right? That I talk so much about reading and literacy, but haven't really thought about it in this way and appreciate it. I love hearing young people read to me from the novel because they have a different cadence and they arrive at the words and language with a different musicality, and it kind of shows me different gateways into the text that I didn't imagine. And so I would love to bring the Braille novel into a space where I could hear folks read out loud and see what they're doing with the language. It's also expanding my understanding, right, of when I go into these spaces, you know, where are the children who are blind and what are they reading and what books do they have access to? We talk about diversity on a grand scale, but, you know, if we don't have these texts in Braille, then, you know, there's a population of children that has even less access to diversity and these worlds. And so I love that this conversation is making me think more broadly about, you know, a community that maybe I've been remiss in considering when I'm writing these stories and in advocating for how do I get these books in Braille for these children.
Elizabeth Acevedo, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I hope you enjoy your trip over to the UK for the Carnegie Medal ceremony, and I'll look forward to speaking to you again.
Thanks so much, Ren. It was great to be here with you.
Mira, muchacha, is mommy's favorite way to start a sentence. And I know I've already done something wrong when she hits me with, look, girl. This time it's, mira muchacha, Marina from across the street told me you were on the stoop again talking to los vendedores. Like usual, I bite my tongue and don't correct her, because I hadn't been talking to the drug dealers, they'd been talking to me. But she says she doesn't want any conversation between me and those boys, or any boys at all, and she better not hear about me hanging out like a wet shirt on a clothesline, just waiting to be worn, or she would go ahead and be the one to wring my neck. Oíste? She asks, but walks away before I can answer. Sometimes I want to tell her, the only person in this house who isn't heard is me.
Poet X by Elizabeth Acevedo is out now in print and ebook. Currently, only a US version of the audiobook is available, but plans are afoot for a UK recording. Braille and giant print copies are available from RNIB Library. You're listening to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. Before we hear from a past Philip Carnegie Medal winner, Kate Saunders is famous for adding a dash of magic to her books for children, most notably in her Belfry Witches series. And in The Land of Never Endings, she explores childhood bereavement with a sense of magical humour that is, at the same time, both heartbreaking and side-splittingly funny. Kate joined me down the line. Kate Saunders, welcome to Read On.
Hi.
So for those who haven't yet read the book, could you introduce us to it, please?
It sounds as if it's going to be very, very sad, and there are lots of sort of sad things in it, because it's actually about grief and bereavement. But I wanted to write a funny story as well, which I know it doesn't sound like they mix up, but my heroine, Emily, has lost her older sister, who's died after 15 years of being severely disabled. And in her intense loneliness that you get with bereavement, she can't articulate one of the things that she misses, which is her sister Holly's teddy bear that she used to tell stories about. And she finds out that due to a lot of strange kind of confabulations of magic, two strange toys appear in her sister's bedroom one night, and they can talk and they can move. And these strange toys, in fact, belonged to the son of the lady next door, Ruth, and he died, and they were his toys. And so it is about the things that stay, in a way, and it's about the kind of space of imagination and fun, if you like, that is worth saving when somebody dies. If that doesn't sound too grim, which I hope it doesn't.
No, I mean, it's very much a book about remembering, celebrating the life of the person who's passed away and the fun that you had with them, whilst also leaving space to grieve for their loss.
Absolutely. And I think it's part of the grieving in a way, and it's one of the hardest things to pin down. But it's part of what you miss about the person, I think. The imagination and fun and the games you had.
Emily and her sister Holly created an imaginary world called Smockeroon, where they
That's right, an imaginary world where toys live when you're not looking. Because, as you know, when you have lovely stuffed toys, they're often just on your bed when you're away at school or wherever. And the idea is that when you're not there, they have a whole rich, enormous and complicated life. And that this fantasy world in my story coincides with another very old fantasy world about three ancient toys who belong to a famous writer that was kind of loosely based on C.S. Lewis. But he buried his old toys in the garden. And they basically reappear. And it's the idea of imaginary worlds kind of running into one, if you like.
And I suppose also there's the suggestion that when Emily's sister has passed away, she might not be in the world that Emily's still inhabiting, but she could well be off enjoying her own adventures in another world.
Absolutely. You remember, I think it's, you know, without being too kind of grim or even too sentimental, but it's not a great leap of imagination for Emily to think that Holly still goes to visit her old toys and remember the fun that they had with the games about Smockeroo.
And there's a real sense of adventure and fun. It's a very visual book. You described the tent that Bluey the teddy bear is marching around very, very visually. It's a multicoloured world, isn't it?
Well, I'm glad you say so, because yes, I wanted to emphasise that the world of Smockeroon, the land of never endings, is a toys. Well, it's like heaven in a sort of silly way, but it's a very silly place, a very funny place, because toys are daft. So you get the comedy from that and the colour, and there's a sort of streak of adventure because something happens, which I won't give the story away, but the toys and the magic start seeping into the boring everyday world.
Absolutely. And there's what I thought one of the most striking characters is the black stinky toad, the toad who stinks of sadness.
Yes, he's grief. The toad is grief. I mean, which sounds very pretentious, but he's a horrible, warty, nasty black toad. Keeps trying to break into Smockeroon and spoil the happiness of the toys, like grief will, you know. And it was a kind of useful thing to kind of articulate the way that it keeps trying to get into your life and keeps taking you by surprise. Everywhere you look when you're bereaved, if you're not careful, you will glimpse the black toad.
Rather like Winston Churchill's black dog.
A little bit like that. I think that it's just this kind of ever-present grief, which never leaves you. And part of the book's message, if it has a message, I think, is that you kind of have to learn to live with it. It was important to me to write for children who knew what it felt like to lose a sibling, lose a parent. And it's particularly hard for children because people just don't know what to say. They don't know how to handle it. I lost my son when he was 19, about 6 years ago. And that, of course, informed so much about this book. It's funny being a writer, what comes out.
I mean, it must have been very difficult for you to have his shadow standing over your shoulder, but presumably also quite an inspiration as well.
Oh, totally. I mean, the awful thing is they don't haunt you. You wish they would. And it was a way of keeping something of him and memorialising something that was very important to both of us, really, which was the stories that we had about his stories when he was little.
Yours isn't the only book on the Philip Carnegie shortlist to address grief. Do you feel that it's an area that our society has forgotten how to address?
Yes, I do. I think it's the most difficult thing you can write about, and it's certainly a very difficult thing to live through. And it's an appalling sort of burden on you that other people are very bad at understanding. And I was careful in my book, though, to show that other people are often very good at understanding it if you know how to articulate it. For instance, Emily has a very nice teacher who lost her little brother when she was a child, so she's extremely understanding about what it's like.
And you have also written continuations of series by E. Nesbitt, the five children on the Western Front, and of Winnie the Pooh, the best bear in the world. Do you think there are lessons that we can take from the great children's authors of the past?
All the time. I mean, that's one of the kind of things in the book as well, that the old imagination of the Edwardian children who owned the ancient toys is just as strong and just as necessary and as self-protective. And in a way, it's trying to stand up for the fact that there's this place that there is no sadness in it. And that's assuming that there will be sadness in your everyday life, which is, all of this sounds, I'm making it sound much more depressing than I wanted it to be. It is sad, but it's also about fun.
I was lucky enough to be able to listen to the audiobook version, and it makes a fantastically fun audiobook. You must be delighted that by having audiobook versions, you can reach a wider audience of people who might not be able to read print.
I think audiobooks are fabulous. What is so nice about audiobooks is that it's not just the blind and partially sighted that like them. Everybody likes them. I know people who drive to the sound of audiobooks, who like to just have them on while they're cooking. They're lovely.
Well, you have produced a book that not only pulls at the heartstrings of the reader, but also tickles their ribs and stimulates the funny bone. And I hope many, many people will read it and feel the same mix of emotions, but ultimately positivity.
Yes, I really hope so. That would make me feel very proud if I felt that there was some kind of uplift and to take away from it, really.
Kate Saunders, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's just not fair, said Maze. I shouldn't have to hang about at the surgery after school. It's so boring. You won't let me use my phone and there's nobody to talk to. Maze, short for Maisie Miller, had been Emily's best friend since forever. Their gardens backed onto each other, so that they had always been able to run between the two houses without crossing any roads. She was a tall, confident person with a loud voice, a big mouth, and long black hair that she could sit on. And she was planning to be famous for something when she grew up. Emily was shorter and quieter, with thin blonde hair, a pale face, and embarrassing big feet that she kept tripping over. "Do stop moaning," said Maisie's mother. "For the last time, I'm not leaving you alone in the house." Maisie's mum, Jo, was one of the doctors at the very busy local health centre, and this was her day to drive Maisie and Emily home from their new school. "You can always do your homework."
"No, I can't. I need some time to relax first. Don't blame me if I fail all my exams. You should have let me go to summers."
Harriet Carmichael narrating The Land of Never Endings, written by my guest Kate Saunders. It's available in Braille, giant print and as TB24756. Now, before we return to hear the books of Sophie Anderson's life, let's hear from last year's winner. Geraldine McCorcoran is a British writer with an international reputation. She's written more than 160 books and been translated into 45 languages. Many of her works are adaptations for children of classic stories, such as Gilgamesh, The Odyssey, The Canterbury Tales, and 1001 Arabian Nights. Her latest novel, Where the World Ends, transports the reader back to 1727 and a remote Scottish sea stack, upon which a small group of boys and men have seemingly been abandoned. Geraldine McCorcoran, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So, can you tell us a little bit more about Where the World Ends?
It's an idea that I got from, well, initially I read Judith Schalansky's beautiful Atlas of Remote Islands. And it's a non-fiction book that is just full of stories, real-life stories. Then my daughter went off on a surprise visit to St Kilda and came back so full of the place, so full of its anecdotes and its actual history, she intrigued me just as much as she'd been intrigued. So, I knew of the place. Obviously, everybody knows of St Kilda. It's one of those kind of dream islands, so remote that people barely believe that anyone could have lived there. And it has all of that appeal of an island where, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to live that remotely? Wouldn't it be splendid to be so self-sufficient and not have to go out and earn a living except just to gather your food and raise your crop? And also, it has that frisson of, what would it be like to be marooned entirely on your own, miles from anywhere, no contact with the mainland, except perhaps twice, three times a year, no help if there's a disaster. So the two elements, as with any island, it just begs to have a book written about it. And there have been lots of books about St Kilda, lots of adult non-fiction books, but no children's books.
Certainly, I've read one in the past about the Googa hunters, the fowlers who go out and collect birds and bird eggs, but it was very much an adult book, and I was intrigued to see how you would handle it and make it accessible for children whilst not being grim. And then I read at the end that this is actually based on a true story, that these boys and men were marooned on the sea stack in the early 1700s.
That's right, yes, they were. And I, of course, the author in me just thought, what did they think while they were there? What sense did they make of it? Imagine that you're sent out to gather birds, as boys are every summer. A couple of men and a bunch of boys go out there to reap the fantastic harvest of baby googas and the other birds for feathers and oil and meat, which is great. It's almost like a holiday away from your parents and you're on your own and you're doing what you're best at. And then nobody comes to get you. And you wait around and still nobody comes. And I thought, well, what went through their minds? What did they think might have happened? And one of the conclusions I came to was that they would assume that the world had come to an end and that they'd been left behind by the angels in the rapture because they were not where they'd be expected to be, not where anybody would be expected to be, on a rock sticking up out of the sea. But, of course, the summer dies and the autumn comes and it starts to be winter and it's a ghastly, horrendous place to be stuck without any expectation of being rescued. because clearly the world at large has forgotten about you.
And it's very much about the power of stories to keep up morale, to explain, and actually to control the very small population that is living on the island, how storytelling is used as part of human existence.
Yes, that's right. And you notice I put it in the hands of a child who is the one that knows the most stories and cares most about stories. So the adults aren't coping at all well, but Quilliam, tells stories to try and stop the boys panicking and to try and make them less homesick and to try and make them laugh and just as you say, keep morale up. I always like stories within the story, so it appeals very much to an author to have a character in the story that tells stories.
Is the implication then maybe that adults have lost the power of imagination and it is only the children represented by Quilliam who can still take a flight of fancy to a better place?
Perhaps. Although they can't do it, Quill's the only one among them that can do it. I like to think that all children can take flights of fantasy to places, but I would venture that most of them are the readers. Those that read books, a lot of children I come across don't really grasp the concept of escaping into the imagination. Personally, I've always had an interior imaginary world where I can go when I'm fed up. And I think it's one of the great joys of childhood, or it was when I was a child, and of reading, is that it gives you the capacity to create your own interior world, and where no one can hurt you, nobody, and everybody loves you, and you're everything that you want to be. So I'm quite in favour of encouraging children to use their interior world, their imagination, to create themselves a happy place.
And another way in which books are made accessible to all by the RNIB Library and also by yourself is to have them made into talking or audio books and also Braille and giant print copies. You must be delighted that, well, maybe you don't know, that there is a large number of your books available in all accessible forms from the RNIB Library for blind and visually impaired readers.
I'm delighted. Totally delighted. Myself, I love audiobooks because I'm a very slow reader. It takes me ages to read a book. And so I always loved audio, and I think it's... I'm so proud when my books get made into audio. But that's absolutely splendid. I did know about a couple, but I'd be really interested to know how many of my books are available out there.
An awful lot more than you would probably guess, actually. There's quite a big number came up on the search that I did. And as I say, it's in all three accessible formats, which is always lovely to see as well.
I have got a Braille copy somewhere. I do. I carry it around and show it to schools when I visit. It's a thing of beauty. I don't know if it's my... I can't remember whether it's my Carnegie book, but it certainly is one of them that I was sent. Because I think I asked for it because I wanted to show the various different ways of accessing a story.
Geraldine McCorkerin, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Thanks to Geraldine McCorkerin. Where the World Ends is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, where you'll also find many more of Geraldine's brilliant books for children and young adults. Now it's back to Sophie Anderson for the books of her life. So, Sophie, was there a book that you read as a child that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
The book that made me fall in love with reading, I think, was the Moomin's books by Tove Jansson. So the first one I read was Finn Family Moomin Troll, but then it set me off. There's a whole series, and it set me off reading them all. And they were the first books that I really remember reading and thinking, they're just wonderful. They really sort of shaped my thinking about what a book could be, because they're full of imagination, but they're also quite deep and philosophical. And it really sort of gave me the idea that books can create whole worlds, not just stories, but like an entire world, because the Moomin's books are set in an entire fantasy world that is similar to our own, but it's populated with incredibly imaginative creatures, sort of things that I'd never dreamed, you know, possible. And those books definitely inspired me greatly. And so, yes, I think the Moomin's books are something that I love, and I still reread them now quite often.
The Moomin family had been living for some weeks in the valley where they had found their house after the dreadful flood, which is another story. Note, it was painted blue. Moomin houses usually are. Translator. It was a wonderful valley, full of happy little animals and flowering trees, and there was a clear, narrow river that came down from the mountain, looped round Moomin House, and disappeared in the direction of another valley, where no doubt other little animals wondered where it came from. One morning, it was the morning that Moomin Troll's papa finished building a bridge over the river, the little animal, Sniff, made a discovery. There were still plenty of things left for them to discover in the valley. He was wandering in the forest when he suddenly noticed a path he had never seen before, winding mysteriously into the green shadows.
There are many Moomin books in the RNIB library in a full range of accessible formats, including Comet in Moominland, narrated by Karen Cass. It's TB20725. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, that would be Anne of Green Gables, which is another book from my childhood. I think the books you read when you're a child really stay with you, and Anne of Green Gables feels like an old friend. So if I ever need a bit of comfort, or it's rainy or I'm poorly, I'll pull out Anne of Green Gables, and I'm instantly sort of taken back to when I'm 12 years old, curled up with it, safe at home, reading it. And I adore that book. I really do. I don't think it's quite an old book, but I don't think it's it shows its age. It's still just beautiful. And I know young girls and boys who read it now, and they still enjoy it, which is really fabulous.
"Do you know," said Anne confidentially, "I've made up my mind to enjoy this drive. It's been my experience that you can nearly always enjoy things if you make up your mind firmly that you will. Of course, you must make it up firmly. I'm not going to think about going back to the asylum while we're having our drive. I'm just going to think about the drive. Oh, look! There's one little early wild rose out. Isn't it lovely? Don't you think it must be glad to be a rose? Wouldn't it be nice if roses could talk? I'm sure they could tell us such lovely things. And isn't pink the most bewitching color in the world? I love it, but I can't wear it. Red-headed people can't wear pink, not even in imagination. Did you ever know of anybody whose hair was red when she was young, but got to be another color when she grew up?"
"No, I don't know as I ever did," said Marilla mercilessly. "And I shouldn't think it likely to happen in your case either." Anne sighed.
"Well, that is another hope gone. My life is a perfect graveyard of buried hopes." That's a sentence I read in a book once, and I say it over to comfort myself whenever I'm disappointed in anything.
"I don't see where the comforting comes in myself," said Marilla.
"Why? Because it sounds so nice and romantic, just as if I were a heroine in a book, you know? I am so fond of romantic things, and a graveyard full of buried hopes is about as romantic a thing as one can imagine, isn't it? I'm rather glad I have one."
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB5619, which is narrated by Elizabeth Proud. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, I think it's another series. The first one is called Podkin One Ear by Kieran Larwood. And there's a few books in the series now. And I've read them in recent years with my children. And I think they are just brilliant family reads or individual reads. I think people of any age could enjoy them. They're like a cross between Lord of the Rings and Watership Down. I think they're future classics in the making. It's another really imaginative world, really brilliant storytelling,
There's adventure and mystery and beautiful characters, and there's a blind rabbit in as well, so there's a character who's blind, and they're just fabulous books, really, really good books for anybody, so I would recommend those. So they're by Kieran Larwood, and it's called The Five Realms series, and I did have a look, and I do know there is an audiobook of that available, so that's fab too.
All walks of life hidden away in cosy, torch-lit underground houses, all arranged around every Warren's hub, the Longborough. A great feasting hall with a huge fireplace, rows of tables, and nearly always music. Music, noise, and merriness. That is what rabbits love. Especially tonight, for this was Bramblemas Eve, the night on which the winter solstice was celebrated with a special feast and the promise of presents in the morning, left behind by the mysterious Midwinter Rabbit. And stories, of course, special stories told by a visiting bard, that is, if he ever got inside the place. Boom, boom, boom! He smacks the doors again and is about to do so a third time when he hears a muffled voice on the other side. All right, keep your ears on, I'm coming! There are more words about stupid people being outside on this kind of night, but luckily the heavy wood absorbs most of those. Finally, the doors creak open, spilling golden torchlight onto the snow, and the face of a burly soldier rabbit pokes out. "Who in the goddess's name are you?" he says, glaring at the stranger. Underneath the hood, the pale green eyes glare back. "Is that any way to treat a bard? Come to tell tales on the eve of Bramblemas? Is that how the old ways are kept here at Thornwood?"
The Legend of Podkin One Ear, Book 1 in the Five Realms series by Kieran Larwood, is available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. An audiobook version is available commercially, narrated by Dan Bottomley. Sophie Anderson, thank you so much for sharing your obvious joy of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.